And Little Lee Golden for you this morning. Good morning, enemy combatants. Degreaser here. Last night, there was an event over in Oakland, part of what's now called Constitution Summer. There is obviously a need to impeach Bush, and a variety of law students and scholars have gotten together to put together four articles of impeachment against not only Bush, but Cheney, Rumsfeld, pretty much the whole list, Rice, Alberto Gonzalez, just name them. And we were able to videotape the event, and I'll play the audio here, and we can then post it online for further perusal. There were a good variety of people there. It wasn't entirely a packed house, but it wasn't bad. It was probably 80% filled. Pretty nice. Bill Goodman is the director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. And then Daniel Ellsberg was also there in his role as probably something both a historian and someone who took part in the downfall of a president about 30 years ago. So without further ado, let's listen to the July 19th Oakland, California forum on how to impeach a president.
Hi, folks. I'm Jeff King. I'm the president of Constitution Summer. We are a mostly youth-led group that is nonpartisan. Coming out of law schools and universities around the country. We're the folks who are responsible for the Berkeley Ballot Impeachment Initiative. And these are the private citizens, but we'd also like to thank very much the public officials who made that happen. Chris Worthington is here. Jason Overman's here, Steve Friedkin, who actually helped draft, mostly drafted the language that we then worked on is here. And if there's anybody else, raise your hand. Okay. We actually prematurely invited Ron Dalton, prematurely put him on our flyer, and want to apologize for that. That was our mistake. So in any event, we put impeachment on the ballot in Berkeley. It got a lot of press. And we are working now to do that in other cities, or help other cities do that, and we're hoping they will. I don't have a whole lot to say because, obviously, I pale in comparison to the people sitting next to me. So I guess I'd just like to thank everybody for coming out. I would like to mention that Santa Cruz next week will be looking to, they're going to have their city council going to consider putting impeachment on the ballot based on our language. So, if any of you are from Santa Cruz, or have ties to Santa Cruz, it might be a good time to visit. I believe that's the 25th. And there may be other cities in California. As Sheena Katadal from the Center for Constitutional Rights mentioned, there's Rule 603 of Thomas Jefferson's Rules of Parliamentary Procedure, which actually allows a state legislature to send articles to the House. We think it would be great to see California do that. And there is a resolution pending in California that if we can put pressure, may move forward. This is Bill Goodman. He is the legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. He's going to be speaking, and then Dr. Ellsberg will be speaking. There will be a Q&A session. Beforehand, if we have folks along the aisles with question cards, so if you'd like to ask a question, if you could fill that out during one of the talks, and then at the end we'll be collecting them, and the two experts can actually address them, and I'll just moderate. Yes.
Okay. Well, good evening, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here, an honor to be here, and I want to congratulate Constitution Summer for the wonderful work it's done in organizing this meeting tonight. So, on behalf of the Center for Constitutional Rights, anyway, welcome to the first annual Impeachment Day event. Because we're coming back. That's our message. Congress doesn't get it. The courts don't step up to the plate. We, the American people, are coming down. And it's not just the marginalized left, not just the remains of the liberal wing of the Democratic Party, or the Center for Constitutional Rights. It's those who can no longer stomach the criminal dismantling of the democratic institutions, indeed of democracy itself in this country. For example, it's the leaders of the Judge Advocate General's office in the Department of Defense who testified against what is going on in Guantanamo recently in Congress, people who would never be expected to chime in on an issue like this. It's the lawyers from the Department of Justice and the Office of Professional Responsibility who wanted to investigate the NSA program, the NSA wiretapping program, and were denied security clearances by the president himself so that that investigation could not go forward. These are people who are a part, not even a part of the mainstream in America. They're part of the Republican Party. Well, not necessarily the Judge Advocate Generals, but they're part of the military establishment. They're part of the right. They're part of the Republican Party. But they cannot stomach this any longer. And they've stepped up to the plate. So our message tonight is that we will be back. And I want to say this. Until tonight, I have not had a chance to see the movie before, which involved statements from myself and all of my colleagues. And while I've heard it before, I didn't quite realize the breadth of the material that would be covered in the film. So if I repeat any of it tonight, I apologize. I've got a few prepared remarks. I would like to start this discussion tonight with a very basic civics lesson. As the way in which the United States government has been constituted for 300 years, there are a few very basic principles that say that the government, the police, the FBI, the CIA, even the President of the United States may not do, and a few things that they must do. So let's just take a look at what, it's pretty basic, it's pretty clear, pretty simple. This is what American government looks like, and this is what American democracy looks like, at least looked like, until the 2000 election. You're not supposed to arrest people without reasonable cause. That's in the Fourth Amendment to the Bill of Rights, it's clear. You're supposed to hold someone without charging them with a crime. And then after you charge them with a crime, you have to bring them before a judge within 48 hours and produce some probable cause as to why they're being held. That's also a guarantee of the Fourth Amendment. You can't lock up people and hold them indefinitely. That's the Fifth, Sixth, the Eighth Amendments of the Bill of Rights. You can't torture people. That's the Fifth Amendment and the Eighth Amendment to the Constitution. In addition, we now know, we recognize that government must acknowledge that incorporated into the Constitution of the United States, incorporated into the legal fabric of our lives, is the basic proposition that international law, both written and customary, is the law of this land, international human rights law in particular. That includes international conventions and treaties. It includes, most recently, things that have been discussed at length, the Geneva Conventions. In addition, a seventh point of society, I've now gone through six basic points of American democracy. Here's the seventh point. American people have a right of privacy. Since 1967, the United States Supreme Court has realized and recognized and proclaimed that right extends to our telephone conversations and now our email conversations. And that is guaranteed by the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution. And that right of privacy, as I said, which was acknowledged for telephone conversations, extends, as of 1972, to a right of a woman to have a choice as to how her body is going to be, who will control her body, whether it be her or the state. And the Supreme Court has said since 1972 that it's her. That's right of privacy, number seven. Number eight, government cannot discriminate against people, at least since the Civil War, based upon race, religion, or ethnicity. And number nine, this government, any government in this country, must allow its citizens to vote for the government. And it must permit that vote of each individual to be counted fairly. I'm glad that there is some applause for that, because it sounds strange after what we've been through for the last 6 years. Much of our experience with violations of these rights, much of our experience at the Center for Constitutional Rights, has been woven into our cases, has been woven into the cases that the lawyers who were in the film tonight described. And not only those cases, but countless of other cases. And here's been our experience. This is what has happened, especially since 9/11, in this country, when you hold the actions of this government up to the template of what I just described, a democracy, the very simple contours the construction of democracy should look like. This president has been assaulting and undermining the Constitution of the United States. Today we're confronted with a grave constitutional crisis. We have a president who is staunchly committed to acquiring unprecedented amounts of power and using it in ways that conflict with the Constitution of the United States, that conflict with international law, that conflict with a common understanding of morality. In other words, although the president has sworn to uphold the Constitution, he is doing just the opposite. He is destroying and dismantling the Constitution of the United States. And he is doing that. He is assaulting and undermining the Constitution in a number of ways. Primarily, his purpose is, as I said, to gather even more power, power that is unprecedented. This presidency is engorged with power, bloated with power, to gather even more power for the president, in particular this president. And that was verified by a statement made by the Vice President of the United States immediately after there was a disclosure of the NSA wiretapping program. What Cheney said was basically admitting, or tacitly admitting, that there was no need for them to have this, to circumvent the FISA courts, to not go to a FISA court, the most compliant court. What Cheney said was, look, it's really not a question of whether we have to go to the FISA court or not. What we need to do is to refurbish, to build up, increase the power of the presidency that has been eroded since when? Since Watergate. Since Watergate, this is what the power of the presidency reached its low mark, according to this vice president, literally probably the most powerful man in the United States, at the moment of Watergate, and now it has to be rebuilt. There have been summary arrests in the United States engaged in by this president. Immediately after 9/11, thousands of non-citizens were arrested, were picked up, were held on ostensible and pretextual immigration charges, but basically they were criminal, they were being investigated for criminal charges. And these men were held under conditions that were, they could best, at best be, in many ways be described as torture. They were routinely beaten, they were kept with, I now can relate to how they felt, they had the lights on 24 hours a day. they were not allowed to sleep, and these men were not brought in front of any judge, despite the fact that the Fourth Amendment requires it, and told what crimes they were charged with. They were ordered deported and held long past their deportation dates, so that they were singled out because of their ethnicity, they were singled out because of their religion, they were singled out because of the fact that they were immigrants, and they were held under terrible conditions. And it's not I that says that. This was all incorporated in a report of the Office of the Inspector General of the Justice Department, who found that the conditions of detention for these men were outrageous. Let's take a moment and take a look at Guantanamo, another example of people who were picked up around the world. Bounties were put up, literal treasures for somebody living in the wilds of Western Afghanistan, who can say for $5,000 the Army will give you five, the United States Army will give you $5,000 if you find us someone who's connected with the Taliban or is connected with Al Qaeda. And of course, they drop a dime on their landlord, or they drop a dime on their tenant, and or whoever, or their political opponent, or someone who's got a job that they want. And literally, I know people at Guantanamo, clients of the Center for Constitutional Rights, in every one of those categories who are there unjustly. The next thing they know, they are drunk, they're handcuffed, they're blindfolded, they're in a plane, and they're in Cuba. And they are not being investigated by the Treasury Department for illegal travel to Cuba either. So, the United States Supreme Court just addressed this issue in a case called Humdan versus Rumsfeld. And in the Humdan case, the opinion is very important because it makes a few salient points. First of all, this executive branch, despite the fact that it thinks it can do whatever it wants, that it is not constrained by the laws of the land, has to comply with the law of the land. It cannot act unilaterally. It has to act with either congressional authority and within the Constitution. And beyond that, and perhaps more important, this administration has to comply with what's called Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions, which means the most basic of human treatments has to occur. People cannot be degraded. They cannot be tortured. They cannot be interrogated in ways that are tortured under Common Article 3. They cannot be detained indefinitely. They have to have a fair tribunal, one which is not a kangaroo court, which is what has been occurring up until now. All of these things were pronounced by the United States Supreme Court 5-3, and really, if you count Roberts, who voted against that position in the D.C. Court of Appeals, it's 5-4. It's close. We're hanging by a thread there, but we won, and we won decisively. When I say we, I mean all of us in the Humdan case, and we should all be very proud of the United States Supreme Court and of what Justice Stevens wrote in that particular opinion. Now, what has the Bush administration's response been to this? It has been, in my opinion, rather brainless, rather moronic, but it has been consistently to undermine the rule of law that was outlined in the light that was shed upon the rule of law by the opinion in the Humdan case. It immediately has confiscated all of the legal papers of prisoners who exist who are being held at Guantanamo. That means letters and documents that we, the lawyers, have brought down to them, have shown them, pleadings, papers, legal letters, have been confiscated so they can't see that. And to resist and to continue to say that the right of habeas corpus, which was upheld for prisoners at Guantanamo 2 years ago in a case called Rizzo versus Bush, still means it's only jurisdictional. The courts only have jurisdiction to hear habeas corpus petitions. Courts do not, that jurisdiction means nothing. Once you get in the door in that courtroom, you still have no rights. This continues to be the position of the Bush administration and this Justice Department. And this is further evidence of the lawlessness of this administration. There's been, of course, suppression of free speech since 9/11, and most dramatically we saw it on the streets of New York during the Republican convention, where again thousands of people were held for days longer than necessary in a place that we called Guantanamo on the Hudson, 57, under conditions that were extremely unpleasant. Only so that they could be held on ice, so that they could, that the Republicans could have their convention and get out of town, and then they were released. And this kind of pattern has been replicated all over this country, throughout the United States, where people have protested the actions of this administration. I know it happened here in Oakland immediately in the run-up to the war in Iraq. Yet worse, this government has sought to eliminate judicial oversight consistently in one area of our government after another, in the area of judicial detention, executive detention, whether it be in Guantanamo or whether it be in the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn, in the area of wiretapping. They've strenuously attempted to undermine any judicial oversight, even the oversight of a court like the FISA court. And that consistent attempt across the board undermine the role of courts is an attempt not only to undermine the role of courts, not only to weaken lawyers and accuse lawyers, which they've done with regard to Guantanamo, by the way, it is an attempt to undermine the rule of law. It is an attempt to say the only law is what we, Bush, Rumsfeld, and Cheney, say that is the law. And let me tell you, ladies and gentlemen, when that is the law, we have no law. That is the basis, one of the strongest bases for impeachment. I want to just talk about the wiretapping program for a moment. Shane Cabell from the Center for Constitutional Rights, I think, talked about the issue fairly clearly. The thing that we have to understand when we talk about impeachment, we talk about high crimes, misdemeanors, and I think that the case for high crimes and misdemeanors has already been clearly made. What needs to be understood here is that the wiretapping which has occurred is wiretapping which is our electronic communications that occur between the United States and outside the United States. Now, it may well be that there has been widespread wiretapping or trolling for telephone conversations and other electronic communications that are purely domestic. That has not been disclosed yet. I suspect that that may underlie some of the resistance of this administration to allowing these lawsuits or to fighting these lawsuits from going forward and having the judge really rule on the constitutionality of this program. But what they admit, what we know, is electronic surveillance that occurs between conversations that occur between someone in the United States and someone outside of the United States. These conversations are clearly, exclusively controlled by a statute called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, otherwise known as the FISA statute or FISA Act. This law not only says that that there is only one way in which these kinds of electronic communications can be intercepted, and that is by getting a judicial warrant from this FISA court, one of the most compliant courts I have ever heard of in my over 40 years of practicing law, a court that has granted over 10,000 of these warrants to the United States government when requested and denied fewer than 10. That's a pretty good batting average. Why in the world would this administration want to subvert and undermine that program when it gets everything it wants by using the judiciary? It is to, as the Vice President of the United States said, to rebuild the power of the president that has been eroded since Watergate. And there are now 100 of these cases in one form or another in which this issue has been raised. There's one that's in San Francisco that I know about that's been filed by the Electronic Frontier Foundation against the communications servers, AT&T or Verizon or whatever it is, out here, Bell West, whatever it is. There's one that's been filed by us and by the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York, a case that I'm very proud of the title, called CCR, Center for Constitutional Rights versus George W. Bush. I'm very proud of that. There's one that the ACLU has filed in Detroit, Michigan. And there are a number of others that are around the country. They are now working in unbelievably strenuous ways to get these cases from being heard. The first thing they've done with all of these cases throughout the United States is file a motion to get the cases dismissed based on something called the state secret doctrine. That means, basically, you can't go there. I'm not going to tell you why you can't go there. That's a secret. I'm not going to tell you anything about it. And judge, you should dismiss it. You can see the documents, but you can't keep them. We'll take them back from you. And now you should dismiss their case, and once you dismiss their case, they can appeal, but they don't know why they're appealing. Now, if this sounds like justice to anyone in this audience, you know, I come from Brooklyn where I can sell you a bridge. So, I really, the state secrets doctrine, which has been used more by this administration in the last 6 years than it has been throughout the history of the existence of this doctrine, which is questionable to start with, is something that I think we're going to see more and more of. And again, it's a way of saying the courts have no business intruding into what the government does, what the president does. We are all powerful. We will not have anything to do with the courts. Another thing they've done is they've gone back to Congress at this point and said, all right, pass a new statute that will say that the constitutionality of this program will be decided by the FISA court itself. In other words, we're going to take all these cases away from these judges out here in San Francisco and the judge in New York and the judge in Detroit and the judge up in Portland, Oregon, and all judges all over the United States. We're going to take those cases away from them. We're going to give them to the FISA court. Now, the FISA court is a court that, unlike all other Article III courts, is appointed, serves temporarily, and is appointed by the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. And this court will decide whether the program is constitutional or not. Well, they're afraid to have some independent-minded judges decide these cases. They're really afraid. They're afraid of what's going to be disclosed. And I think what probably they're fearful of in terms of disclosure is the fact that it's not just calls from the United States to outside the United States. It's vast numbers, millions and millions of millions of electronic communications from me to you, from you to your wife, from you to your boyfriend, girlfriend, or kids, or whatever, or parents. Those are the calls that they're afraid that will be disclosed, and people will realize that not only is the doctrine that the government may not intrude upon our privacy dead, but our privacy is long gone and long dead. And then the people will really rise up, and this movement towards impeachment will grow even stronger. This government has routinely tortured people, not only in Bagram in Afghanistan, not only in black holes around the world of ghost detainees whose names we do not even know, but at Guantanamo, where we do know who the people are, where the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, was on the phone on a weekly basis, understanding the details in which a man named Mohammed al-Qahtani was tortured routinely. These are the things that we can talk about when we talk about torture. As I said, it has been fortunate, I think, it's been personally fortunate for me to be at the Center for Constitutional Rights where we have had these cases like Meher Arar that Marila had talked about, where we can see not only the ways in which the Constitution has been violated, but the vast sweep of the plans and programs of this administration to undermine and destroy the Bill of Rights and the rule of law in this country. And because we have been fortunate enough to find in our workplace, that is in the courts, where we work, is exactly the area that this administration, that George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, that these people do not want us to be because it represents a check on their grandiosity, a check on the bloated power of this particular presidency. I feel it's been particularly enlightening for us to be working in this area. That is why we undertook to write this book. And I don't think there are copies of it out here, but I urge you all to. I think there are order forms. You can get it at a discount. I urge you all to read the book. I think it's pretty well done, pretty useful. Articles of Impeachment Against George W. Bush. Thank you, Dan. I want to just end with a quote. It's from Shakespeare. It's from Julius Caesar. Cassius says, "Why, man, he doth bestride the narrow world like a colossus, and we petty men walk under his huge legs and peep around to find ourselves dishonorable graves. In the end, this enormous challenge provides us all with an enormous opportunity as well to engage the American people in a discourse about what kind of society we want to live in, so that there are no more colossuses. So that we have no need to search for dishonorable graves. So that in this time of dishonor, we have engaged in an honorable task. I urge every one of you, if you haven't seen it, to see the movie Good Night and Good Luck, which is about McCarthy and Edward R. Murrow. And in addition to the fact that it's a great score, Diane Reeves' wonderful sings these great songs in this movie, in addition to that, the message of that movie is that there are three things that tyranny requires and thrives on. One is fear, one is secrecy, and the last one is silence. And that's it. What we have to do, what impeachment means, is that we will not be silent, it will not be secret, we will not be afraid, we will fight that. Impeachment.
Thank you, Mr. Goodman. One thing that I think people will be interested in is organizing. So I would urge you all to take the cards, fill them out, send them up. We have a number of good questions. Dr. Ellsberg is going to speak for a brief time, about 10 or 15 minutes. And then we're going to get to your questions, which are actually very good. One more thing, and that is actions. Lobby your state legislatures, write letters to the editor. If you're from somewhere else in the country initially or originally, do that too. Urge your friends, get people recruited, and especially read the book. Our group, Constitution Summer, formed after having read this book. It is a fantastic book. It's comprehensive, it's comprehensible, it's short, it's cheap, it's small, it's very easy to digest for regular people, and I think it gives people strong arguments that they can then discuss over their dinner tables with all sorts of folks like-minded or not. So with that, I'll turn it to the incomparable Daniel Ellsberg. It's an honor to see you again.
Too loud? No, listen, the problem with the lights, I was laughing because it reminds me of the single most embarrassing moment of my public life that I can remember, which I will share with you. I don't think I've ever mentioned it to anyone before. My wife is the only other person who experienced this with me. I was soon, when I had just gotten on trial, or in the fall of 1971, somebody did a documentary on me, which was to be shown in Cambridge, where I was living there, and at some theater, and I was asked to speak afterwards. And I was a little embarrassed by the documentary because the interviews with me and so forth, but it was quite adulatory and had some very romantic pictures of me and my wife walking on Walden Pond, which was nice, but it was kind of a little dramatic. And so when that ended, the lights were just like this, which is, they were shining right in our eyes, and couldn't see the audience at all. You're invisible out there. It could just be a laugh track out there. It's like being president. We're in a bubble here. We don't even can't even see the people out there. So I felt that wasn't good, and I wanted the house lights to be put on, which I was asking here. I don't know what the problem is. I know it's a movie theater, but there must be house lights. And so I looked up at the people, the technicians who had the lights up there, and it was going like this. And the audience raggedly and bit by bit began to stand up under the impression that I was asking for a standing ovation. They had not given me spontaneously, actually. It was quite embarrassing. But anyway, so it goes. If you read the paper this morning, you will have seen pictures in the San Francisco Chronicle of the president giving a back massage to Angela Merkel and didn't seem to like it. And there's a number of columns by Mark Morford and others, and even on the front page, saying how embarrassing a president is, how sophomoric, what a frat boy he still is, you know, humiliates us and so forth. The problem we're facing here, and the reason for impeaching this president, is not that he's embarrassing, it's that he's dangerous. I don't think he is a fool. This is not a joke. He has some kind of a reading problem, which proves nothing about his intelligence. Everybody who sees him says he's not a fool. I can believe that, as a matter of fact. But I say the problem is not that he's a fool. The problem is that he's dangerous. He's dangerous to the security of this country and the world, and he's dangerous to our democracy. Dangerous to our democracy. The passage you were reading from Julius Caesar was about a man who would be king, who would be emperor, who eventually would be God. Upon what meat hath this our Caesar fed? They regarded him as dangerous to the Republic, and they assassinated him. Now, neither impeachment, nor even not even mention the other word, would protect us from the dangers we are facing right now. Even getting rid of Bush by impeachment or by other means would not protect us. After all, we have now no longer in the government. We don't have Wolfowitz, he sloughed off, Pearl, Fife, they've Ashcroft, they've all gone, and what difference has it made? When it comes to people of really bad judgment, this team has depth. And of course, it's not quite. We don't have to worry about impeaching Bush, and then we'll reach up with Cheney. I'll come to that in a moment. We're quite a ways from impeaching Bush. What I'm talking tonight about, and the reason I'm here, is because I think it is essential to be part of a movement and to be pressing for the impeachment of Bush. For us as a people, for us to be demanding that our Congress define the actions of this administration and this president as impeachable, as high crimes and misdemeanors, defining that, whether we can get a majority of the House, Republican or Democrat, to agree to that or not, it's essential. Because nothing could be clearer than that this president, in full public view, is in fact not just violating the law. Presidents do that, all presidents do that. Not just that he's been caught, but he's declaring quite openly he's above the law. That's the clear and explicit meaning of statement after statement that he makes and that his lawyers make for him, that no law applies to him. He believes himself to have the powers of a king, at least while we're at war, and he has declared an endless war. He didn't get that idea by himself. He has relied on the statements of four or five lawyers, several of whom he has regarded as fit for higher office, and the Senate has confirmed them, basically. But if you read Jane Mayer's excellent piece a few weeks ago, in the New Yorker, on David Addington, who is now the chief of staff of Vice President Cheney, a lawyer who replaced Libby, when Libby was indicted, who has been with Cheney for a very long time, since he was in the Congress, if not before that, but I think it was in Congress where he first worked for Cheney. And in fact, maybe you'll remember, but I think that Addington was the person who wrote for him a dissenting opinion on impeachment. Am I not right on that one? On Watergate? There was he wrote a famous dissenting opinion.
I don't know.
We'll go into that. But anyway, the point is on the article that Addington has sold him as a lawyer on this clear point of view, which was also shared by John Yoo, Y-O-O, by Bidey, now made a federal judge, by Gonzalez, who at that time was counsel to the president, having worked for him in Texas, written for him the recommendations for the death penalty over and over again in Texas, and is now, after it is revealed that he was the author of many of the legal opinions that led to the torture, the rendition, the wiretaps, all of these unconstitutional and illegal actions, Gonzalez is the attorney general, as we know. And until these revelations came out, by leaks in every case, it's the only way we know those legal opinions, until then he was a leading candidate for Bush to put on the Supreme Court. Alito was an early desire of this point of view of the presidency, which Yu has written a whole book about in his current capacity as professor at law school in Berkeley. Now, the shocking thing is not so much that he went back to a judge, to a professorship at Berkeley, but that his bizarre and essentially authoritarian, I could say fascist, people say Nazi, well, yes, Nazi, but also Italian, Japanese, Franco, not just the Germans, Nazis had this point of view, a point of view of executive power, which is variously referred to as unitary executive, or another reference to the inherent powers of a president in wartime, inherent powers that the Congress cannot touch, that the Congress, which are the powers to do anything, really anything. Yu is a guy who's willing to carry the logic of that to any extreme you want to challenge him to. When he was asked by, I believe, a Notre Dame law professor on a program, do you believe that the president has the power to order that the child of a suspect be tortured? I think he may have been so specific as to say to have the testicles crushed of a boy in front of his parents to compel him. But in any case, he said tortured. You said that I would want to know why the president felt that was necessary. In other words, were his reasons for finding it necessary, adequate to satisfy me? If there's something that would not satisfy you that's necessary, he's never said what it would be. As I say, what is shocking is I'm not aware of a single law professor at Bolton who has risen publicly to challenge you to that, these positions, to challenge those, to write law review articles saying this is a point of view that is the legal underpinning of fascism. As a matter of fact, a number of these people, as you can find, by the way, if you look it up on Google or something, are actual fans of a law professor and juris scholar named Carl Schmitt, who was, in fact, the lead. He was, by the way, a teacher of Leo Strauss. I think it was Schmitt who helped Strauss get into this country. Again, Strauss, of course, the guru of a lot of the neocons. But Schmitt was the leading jurist of the Nazi regime before that. And his views on the powers of the executive are, I believe, admired by most of the people who are advising the president here now. Ivy, as I said, is another one here in the Justice Department who is now the a judge on an appellate court. One more, William Haynes, wrote opinions on this. I forget what his job was at the time. He was in the Army Department, I believe. Anyway, he's up for a high legal position now, of course. All of these people got through confirmation. That is the ones who, Alito and Roberts, who's another one who shares these views, of the absolute powers of the executive, now on the Supreme Court. Both got confirmed without being pressed on the implications of this view of theirs on the inherent presidential powers, the king-like powers. The administration has, one of Rule's lines is that the Democrats are in a pre-9/11 mentality. And someone, I think it was Feingold, who said, well, these people are in a pre-1776 mentality. But I'm not sure George III could have gotten away with all the things this guy is doing. There was, after all, a parliamentary monarchy, considerable extent. He was subject to the Parliament's judgments on budget to some extent. Granted, there are a lot of rotten boroughs, and our main complaint was that the court of King George III, our main complaint about Parliament, was the undue influence, the corrupt influence that the court had over Parliament. And essentially then an executive that ran without an independent branch really controlling them. I have a feeling that in some respects they have a pre-Magna Carta mentality. When it comes to habeas corpus, that's after Magna Carta. But what is it, about 10th or 12th century? Yeah, right. Yes, right. Well, they really go back for their traditions. And it is not the tradition of this country that started in 1776. Now, to say that these people are usurping power, that they are abusing power, that they have, in effect, run a kind of coup right now, is to be regarded as, is to be called by them a traitor. And not only by Ann Coulter, that's almost a compliment. If you're not called a traitor by Ann Coulter, it's like not being on Nixon's enemies list. Gee, who am I? But no, traitor by the president and the vice president use these terms. You are giving aid and comfort to the enemy. Those are the words of the treason, a definition of treason. And they use them, of course, they used it about Tom Daschle, the man of the Senate majority leader, I guess. And he was giving aid and comfort to the enemy. He was defeated. If you're not willing to be called traitor, if you're not willing to, by these people, if you're not willing to be called unmanly or weak or unpatriotic or un-American, you cannot say what needs to be said about what is going on in the White House and in Washington right now. You have to be willing to face up to that genocide and something that goes really on. Frankly, it's not easy to get used to that. I could say I have, finally. I've heard it so much in the last 35 years. But it's hard at first. People don't like that. Barbara Lee, for example, had the courage to be the one person. He's willing to say, as Senator Morse had said almost 30 years earlier, that or more, that in the Tonkin Gulf Resolution, to say that for the Congress to vote in favor of the war against Afghanistan after 9/11, without hearings, without debate, without participating in the process, was unconstitutional and was wrong. And she knew she would be called names for that, traitor. I just read the other day she had to have a police guard at some point for the death threat she got. She is an example of what we need very much and what we have very little of in Congress. As I say, Michael Hayden, the general who was carried out these illegal warrantless wiretapping programs for the president, as head of the National Security Agency. A program which I've been told by someone just from NSA, Russell Tice, who's a whistleblower who's trying to be heard now in Congress, he told me there were thousands of people in NSA who understood that this program was totally illegal, went against everything they'd been told was within the NSA charter. They were anguished about it. Some of them leaked about it, to their credit. But anyway, here you have Hayden going along and doing this, whether reluctantly or enthusiastically, for which he should have been court-martialed. Instead of even being given a Medal of Freedom yet, I guess that lies ahead, he is made by the president head of the Central Intelligence Agency instead of being court-martialed. Obviously, a man who will do anything for the president. What that is to say is that these people are really not only doing everything they can quite openly to roll back the New Deal, the Fair Deal, the Great Society, all of the social democratic welfare provisions, rights that have been won over the last 60, 70 years, which is fairly open on their part. They are in the process of rolling back freedoms that are more than 200 years old in this country and changing our form of government. If we go along with, let's say, the Democrats in Congress who say, oh, we can't talk impeachment. First of all, we're a minority, so we can't vote it by ourselves. Well, that's true. It's true that Lyndon Johnson, who committed just as many impeachable offenses as Nixon did, and as Bush has done. I would say that nothing that Bush has done so far is actually without precedent, and without precedent by Democrats as well as Republicans. Johnson, for example, had NSA listening to millions of Americans, including every anti-war leader. He also was his wiretapping every move that Martin Luther King made, with the approval or the signing on of Robert Kennedy at that time, Attorney General. The difference here is that it's hard to imagine Johnson being caught at that, which he wasn't, and then saying, yeah, I'm doing it, and I'm going to keep doing it. It's my power, and love it. And it's a little hard to imagine, but that was a different era. That was an era of democratic control, and not just these Democrats, but Democrats far to the left are more liberal than these are now. As a matter of fact, I think people pointed out that Nixon's domestic programs were far to the left of those of Bill Clinton in many areas, given the fact that he had a Democratic Congress in a very different mood. But to say that he had a Democratic Congress means that there really was very little chance that Lyndon Johnson would have been impeached by that Democratic Congress if he had been caught out, having lied us into a war as egregiously as we were lied into this war. He wasn't caught in time. But had he been, is it realistic that a Democratic Congress would have really found him guilty of that high crime? I'm afraid not. What about the NSA that he was using? The FBI, the CIA, in an operation called Chaos, very nicely named, was spying on Americans. The Army intelligence, on the whole, as a whole mass of Army intelligence, was operating as secret police, as a political police, infiltrating meetings like this. And I'll be very open here now, not to scare you, I'm defining where we are now. The chance that there are not government representatives in here now recording this program is negligible. It's not worth considering. So I say to them, you are acting as secret police in the United States of America, political police, working on political dissent, defining as treason the criticism, and you should reconsider what you're doing. You should tell your wives or your husbands and your children what you've been doing and get their opinion of it. Actually, that'd be good. Anyway, when we heard earlier if we don't impeach or something, there's no hope. I think one of the women said that on the program. If we have to live with him, I'm afraid we have to deal with more hope than that. I live on a thin diet of hope, fortunately, a little more than that. But it is true, the idea of 3 more years of Bush is intolerable. Intolerable. I would say it is very hard to imagine Nixon having been impeached with all the evidence against him by a Republican Congress. Republicans did vote for the Articles of Impeachment, but they were a minority in Congress, and it was hard to get them, and you couldn't get the Republicans to go along with impeachment for a war we'd been lied into, which was Cambodia. For the Cambodian bombing had to be removed, despite all the lying and the secrecy of it, from the Articles of Impeachment before the committee would vote for them. So a lot of things have to happen here. You will not get an impeachment, and I would desperately like to see an impeachment, not, of course, just of Bush, but of Cheney, Rumsfeld, of all the people. I've gone longer than you said, but not as long as Bill yet, so I'll try to go a little shorter than that, and then just parameters here. It reminds me, for example, that I was just thinking out here something that I really don't remember much these days, you might think I would, that it was crimes against me personally ordered in the White House. There were important parts of 2 of the 3 articles of impeachment of Richard Nixon. His sending in the White House CIA assets, human emigres and CIA assets, into my former psychoanalyst office to get information with which to blackmail me. There was a factor in that. He's not upholding the law, clearly violating the law. That, by the way, would not be so clearly illegal under the Patriot Act. That's how far we've moved here. Voted for by every Democrat in the Senate except one, Feingold, who acted like Gordon Lee in that respect. How about wiretaps? FBI testified in my court case, which lasted almost 2 years, over and over in the court, that I had not been overheard electronically. There was no evidence of it. I have on warrantless wiretaps ordered by President Nixon and Henry Kissinger, carried out by the FBI, kept out of the FBI files, booking procedures, because J. Edgar Hoover knew that they were illegal and he wanted that evidence for blackmail against the White House, particularly. So the evidence was stolen out of J. Edgar Hoover's safe by his number two, who wanted to ingratiate himself with Nixon, and moved over to the White House. That was a factor in ending my trial. But more significantly, there was an illegal, warrantless wiretap, which did figure in the impeachment of the president, which did happen, unforeseeably, but with a lot of unusual conditions. A special prosecutor under a law that no longer exists, unfortunately, much freer than Patrick Fitzgerald in his powers, an opposition party. There will not be an impeachment, I would have to predict, unless there is a Democratic House, and there will not be a conviction without a Democratic Senate, despite how fast this is. It is essential to get a Democratic House for a number of reasons, but not sufficient. Can we count on these Democrats, the incumbents who are getting reelected, pressing impeachment, providing that a precedent again for us? Hardly. These are the same Democrats who just voted confirmation of Michael Hayden and of Alito and of Roberts without even pressing them on these issues. Any Jew like myself who is extremely critical of Israel, as I am, above all the way from that amounts to aggressive war, I would say, by Israel, with the excuse of an irresponsible action by Hezbollah, I would say. But in any case, setting the Middle East on flank, anybody, I will be called for that by various people, not the same people who call me a traitor. Others will call me a self-hating Jew. Well, I brush that one off. That's ridiculous. But if I were to be called a self-hating Democrat, I would find that harder to refute. But that's what we've got. That's what we've got. And here's what, then I'll close with this. It is essential. To press for impeachment is essential. To fail to do that is to be complicit in a change in government in our country, which is in process, which in many respects has already taken place, which our president is increasingly openly proclaiming, a monarchical president with absolute power right now, who bypasses Congress deliberately, even when perhaps he doesn't have to, when he could easily get Congress to agree to what he wants, that he wants to make the point that he is not in any way beholden or restrained by Congress or the Constitution or international law or anything else. We have to say, no, that is not the presidency we want, that we demand. It's not what we aspire to. We've had it in secret at various times in the past when we didn't know it so much. But when we know it, we must define it as criminal and unconstitutional and unacceptable. The list of abuses by King George III that are listed in the Declaration of Independence have nothing on the list that can be made against this president right now. And that was proclaimed out of respect for the decent opinions of mankind as the reason for our revolution, for declaring independence. Now, we got that independence only by a war. And we can't get back the Bill of Rights by an armed revolution in this country. It is my strong belief that acts of terrorism or violence of any kind, such as a few minority people did in Vietnam, helped Nixon prolong the war, helped justify repressive measures with the will of the majority of the people, and that would be true today. I believe that acts of violence right now would have that same effect of legitimating the repression that has already taken place, and which I believe is going to get enormously greater with one more 9/11 or with a war against Iran, toward which we are rushing at this moment. And in that war, I believe we will see it will be too late, in effect. It's now we have to act the freedoms we still do have and use them to keep them. The fact is that the Declaration of Independence led to a process, and not right away either, that gave us institutions that allow us non-violently to change abusive leaders and power. Voting is one of those, and it's essential. Campaigns are essential, lobbying is essential, letter writing, all these things are essential. Right now, a move to impeachment is one measure that has to be done. Nonviolent civil disobedience, fasting, of which I personally am taking part in all of these things, not because I think that any one of them has any high promise, but I'm saying we are in a crisis right now, a constitutional crisis, and a crisis of security. The world will become much more dangerous for the United States, has already done so, of course, because of the Iraq invasion, and will probably never get back, not in my lifetime, not for generations, in terms of our security in the world as a result of that recruiting tool for al-Qaeda. But an attack on Iran, which we are being led to right now, this week, will intensify that enormously. So our security is at stake, as well as our constitutional order. Every nonviolent, truthful thing that means that was used to end the Vietnam War and more than was ever done. Beginnings of a general strike were made in 1969 in a movement called the Moratorium. That was crucial in preventing the use of nuclear weapons by Nixon in the fall of 1969, although we didn't know that. It's important to know that because we're facing the possible first use of nuclear weapons in an escalated war back and forth in the Middle East within months, in my opinion. In fact, I expect before the election, the way things are going right now. I think under this administration, I believe they have encouraged Israel to take, quote, disproportionate acts, that is, acts of war, major war, not only in Gaza, but in Lebanon now, in order to inspire intervention by Iran and Syria, which will justify war against Iran by Israel and by us. And although it seems that the objections of the Joint Chiefs of Staff themselves, according to Cy Hirsch, have ruled out the initial use of nuclear weapons, which the administration was insisting on as an option. And that option has allegedly been taken off the table. But in the case of a war in which Israel, for its, quote, self-defense, in the words of the president, bizarre words, in self-defense, attacks Iran at this point, and Iran reacts against Israel and our troops in Iraq and our shipping in the Gulf, a process of conflict will go on in which I would think the odds are not certain, but 6-5, 7-5, that we will use nuclear weapons against their underground nuclear facilities of any kind. So the crisis could not be greater. I come back. Every nonviolent, every truthful means, and by the way, although this book, I was just checking it, appears to me to be very accurate from what I can see, the movie has to change because statements by Ratner about Article 2 are mistaken. The statements that the president knew he was lying when he talked about aluminum tubes or something are not made in the book, and they are not true. I'm sure Ratner wasn't deliberately lying himself, but was talking carelessly, and there's several things that have to change there. Where the president was lying, consciously lying, was when he said over and over, there is no doubt that our intelligence has proven that. We know where these things are. When he knew and had been told over and over that the evidence for that was controversial, thin, weak, and so forth. That was a lie, and that's sufficient to impeach him on. To say, however, that, for example, it was said by Ratner that he said that Saddam was behind 9/11. Actually, he managed to fool the American people into believing that without ever saying that. He actually never did say that in the book. Makes that clear. What he did was simply say 9/11 and Saddam Hussein in the same sentence or paragraph over and over and over several times in one speech, giving the impression that we're going into Iraq because of 9/11, which clearly means, what else could it mean, that 9/11 was caused by Saddam. But he didn't actually say that. So to say he said it is mistaken. We shouldn't say mistaken things.
Yeah.
Finish with that.
Cheney said.
Cheney, it's another matter. Cheney kept saying over and over about the Muhammad Atta issue. I don't think that Cheney ever said, let's get on that. I don't think Cheney, but let's think of Cheney for that, that's fine. If Cheney said that, but the president did not, that what Cheney did say over and over, having been told the contrary, and is still saying it, that he believes, or it is a fact, that Mohammed Atta met with Saddam Hussein's intelligence in
Czechoslovakia.
Prague. And actually, I just read in the 1% Doctrine by Ron Susskind that the director of intelligence in CIA, Janie Mischick, a woman, told Tenet she would resign if they forced her once again, if they tried to force her to say that was true. She said it is not true on that. Of course, they did keep going and saying, but they didn't say it with the imprimatur of CIA anymore. Later, Cheney tried to get her to lie about something else, to reveal something. She said, no. And somebody Porter Goss sent a note back to her, then head of the CIA, and said, you can't say no to the vice president. And she said to her boss at that point, sometimes saying no to the vice president is what we get paid for. Well, she was wrong. She was fired 2 weeks later. So it was not what Porter Goss was paying her for. We're in a position now where what she did was not enough. Fine. What I've been saying for 2 years, and what I'm going to say now with a greater urgency, it was good what she did. She refused to lie. It was not enough. Knowing that the president was lying, was the Cheney in this case was lying, Cheney, that he didn't lie about. She should have said, not just, I won't lie with you. She should have said to herself, I will expose you. I will oppose this policy. I will not resign. I will tell the truth to Congress and let you fight. I will then go out with documents and I will prove that this is wrong because we're in a crisis. What the traitors who founded this country said, every one of them, a loyal subject of George III in 1774, every one of them subject to being hanged as a traitor in 1776. That's what they were referring to when they said, in pursuit of these principles, and to gain the government that's in our Constitution, ultimately, and our Bill of Rights, which lay ahead, we pledge our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. And we must do no less right now. Thank you.
Folks are interested in asking questions. There are a number here that have already been asked. Dr. Ellsberg's comments about Vice President Cheney lead directly into one of the most popular questions, which is, and it was briefly addressed, but maybe Mr. Goodman, you could address it more specifically. If the president is impeached, do we not get President Cheney?
Well, my starting point for that question is, I think that's what we already have already. Anyway, so leaving that aside, you have to view this as a political a movement, and if we were ever to get to a point where we were in shouting this, it's a real impeachment of this president, that would be such a political victory for the people of this country. That it would substantially undermine any real authority or power that quote, President Cheney would have were he to, were you to get to the point not of impeachment, as Michael Ratner made clear, but of actually conviction of the impeachment in the U.S. Senate, things would have changed so much at that point politically that a President Cheney would be a tremendously weakened and ineffective despot rather than an extremely strong and effective despot, which he is now.
Question on that. What are the practical, I'm sure it's a practical kind of consideration here. What are the considerations against calling right now for the impeachment of Bush, Cheney, and Rumsfeld?
No, I don't know about Rumsfeld. I don't know
about the torturers.
You can impeach probably more than one at a time. The Green Party has endorsed
four of them.
Folks, there are a lot of questions from people, and a lot of people have asked the same questions.
You didn't really ask that question.
Oh, sorry?
You didn't really ask the question about Cheney, because if Cheney were the actual, not behind the scenes, but actual president, he could pardon Bush. And he would be the incumbent in 2008.
Okay.
And we don't have our vote sheets yet.
So we're saying that we can't vote against the vice president. And he's probably quite impeachable.
Sure. Listen, I'm all for it. Let's impeach them both. There's no reason to ask. This book outlines the basis for impeaching. Impeaching Bush, which is a good start. Much of what's in here applies equally or even more significantly to Cheney as it does to Bush. Let's go right. For impeachment against both of them.
For example, Colonel Wilkerson, Colonel Collins, former chief of staff, has said that he's seen a trail of documents which lead directly to the vice president's office, and recently had a piece that puts forth that.
Right, I've heard that. And as I said during my few remarks here, he was directly involved in a number of incidents of torture, in particular one that we know that has been clearly disclosed that involving this guy all the time.
It's
Gonzalez,
too.
Gonzalez. Sure. I mean, it's not limited. I mean, it's used on judges. In fact, I believe the Rule 603, the one precedent, comes from the impeachment of the judge. Is that correct?
You know, a couple of years ago when the impeachment issue came up, I think I said not just jokingly at all, that it was a time when Bush's popularity was quite high. And people said, come on, if you go for impeachment, it's so silly that Congress won't even take it seriously at all. And I said, not jokingly, why not focus on Cheney? Because nobody loves Cheney. I mean, I don't know whether his butter loves him or not. The idea of impeachment seems to me something that even a Republican Congress could contemplate with less resistance than they would for the president or something like that. But of course now, it's only lately, really, that the evidence has come out so plainly about the unconstitutional, illegal actions. Take these NSA wiretaps, which we really only learned about in December 2005, or more than a year after the New York Times learned about it. The New York Times deserves, in its possible threat of prosecution, for putting that out. It's good that they put it out. But what do they deserve for having sat on that through the election of 2004? They gave us George Bush in a very close election by sitting on that evidence during that time. Now that deserves some journalistic equivalent of impeachment, I would say, in the editors and publishers. But now that we have that evidence, just in the last year or so, of course you couldn't just go after Cheney, you have to go after Bush. But I don't really see any reason for not raising the issue right now of Cheney and all the others, as you say, Gonzalez, many others.
And apropos to the wiretapping question, there are several questions about what, if there was no truthful or lawful purpose for the illegal wiretaps and the call tracking, what, I suppose Mr. Goodman first, would be the real purpose? In addition, actually this week, the Daily Count, the student newspaper at UC Berkeley, reported, obviously along with a lot of other publications, on the military spying domestic spying on UC Berkeley anti-war groups, UC Santa Cruz, these FOIA requests that have come out, young people who are organizing in a nonviolent way. And so if you could speak to the supposed real purpose.
Well, there are a number of things. The first thing is the question of why they would not have submitted these warrants to FISA court. And there are a number of possible suppositions or hypotheses. One is that they were engaging in so much in electronic interception that was so clearly illegal and unconstitutional that they were afraid to show it to these very compliant judges. And that's the premise of the Center for Constitutional Rights lawsuit, which is that they were listening to conversations between lawyers and clients, which is, of course, a traditionally, historically acknowledged privilege that's not to be intruded upon by the government, although we know they've done it quite a bit. I know they listened in on my conversations when I went up immediately after 9/11 and saw men who were being held at the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn. And we strongly believe they were listening to our conversations with our clients overseas, their families, and so on. But these would be very embarrassing for them to disclose even to a judge, or probably throw them out the door. There probably are others, journalists and their sources, is probably another example of that. Probably also would have disclosed a whole sea, a subterranean, huge depth of illegal interceptions that are purely domestic. But I think that the basic reason that they didn't want to give this to FISA judges was what Cheney said all along. We want to enhance the powers of this already engorged, bloated presidency in terms of power. And we wanted to enhance their powers even more. And I think that it was really a line in the sand. You know, we're really saying we will refuse, even though Congress has told us we have to, we refuse to cross that line and walk into that judge's chambers and get a warrant. Now, the one point I wanted to make, and it's a good opportunity to make it right now, is that not only is clearly excluded by the FISA statute, it is criminal. That means that these guys have committed crimes, and they have now submitted to Senator Spector has written, probably with someone moving his hand along the paper from the White House, a statute which now says, well, the FISA court's going to make all these decisions, hear all these things. And by the way, we will retroactively eliminate any potential criminal liability. Spector all along plays a very strange and kind of ciphery-like role, but basically I've never seen a mess that this administration has made throughout the years that he's been chairman of the House of the Senate Judiciary Committee that he wasn't prepared to lick up.
And the actual criminal penalties, correct me if I'm wrong, 5 years in prison and a $10,000 fine?
Right, right.
Is that every occurrence potentially?
That's right.
It's a long time, a lot of years.
Yes. Yeah, let me comment on that. The Spector is doing that while he admits that he has not been told what the programs were, that he is legitimate. He didn't hear it from Hayden, who just refused to tell him basically what they were. And Hayden got confirmed without their even demanding that he tell them what he'd done in his past job as head of the NSA. Fairly amazing. And confirmed, by the way, by a number of Democrats like Carl Levin and various others. So that's one thing. There's every reason to think, and I thought the film was good on this, by the way. In fact, I thought the film was good all along, except for those statements by Ratner, which I think really should be changed. And your comments were very good. But it was good on this, that there's every reason to think that there's aspects to that program that would be simply unacceptable. Remember what Nixon was doing on the wiretaps on which I was overheard. It was a program of 17 wiretaps, illegal, warrantless wiretaps. First against people like Mort Helfand's phone, on which I was overheard, and Tony Blair, who worked for Kissinger, to see if they had leaked the true story about our illegal bombing of Cambodia. And actually, they hadn't. But that was the basis for those. And then they listened to four newsmen. So newsmen were being wiretapped at that point, as well as even officials who were accused of being leakers. That's not going on now. There's no chance of that. The journalists are not being listened to. The lawyers are not being listened to. Now, an interesting comparison is this other story. An interesting comparison is this other story that they're going against the Times now ferociously for revealing, along with the Wall Street Journal and the LA Times, the so-called SWIFT tracking of international wire transfer. Now, that's been told quite a bit. May well be legal, probably is legal. The story here, I would say, and considerably significant, was they didn't tell it to Congress. Now, almost surely, if that's what they say it is, Congress would have approved that. So why didn't they tell? I think just on the principle. Cheney's principle, Addington, you, Biden, and the presidents. We don't have to tell the Congress, even the Intelligence Committee, even though the law says we do. But the law doesn't apply to me as a wartime president. And you say, well, it's not written that way. The Constitution is not written that way, that there's one law for wartime, another law for peacetime. You say, that's all right. Inherent powers, unitary executives, we can do whatever we want.
Very quickly, Milligan, actually, ex parte Milligan, from just after the Civil War, says that there is one constitution for wartime and peacetime, and it's the same constitution.
Indeed, Milligan does say that. It sounded a little too late for Mr. Milligan, I think. But,
indeed.
But let me just go back to part of that question that I didn't get to. And that goes to the question of the intrusion of military surveillance into domestic protest, anti-war protest in particular in this country. There's no question this is going on. That we have, I have been approached by a number of anti-recruitment groups that, as many of you probably know, it was on NBC, for example, I think it was on 60 Minutes or something like that. There's a long, huge index of targeted protests that military intelligence picks up on, and knows about most of these because it has infiltrated many of our groups, many protest groups, anti-recruitment groups, Quaker Friends meetings, all of these kinds of things in which the military has now become a part of the fabric of our lives. And by the way, our local police departments as well, there's no question this is widespread in New York City, I know. And the fact is that Lyric versus Tatum, which was a situation that you referred to in your talk, when there was military involvement in the anti-war protest movement during the Vietnam War, says that in that particular case we can't prove an injury because they're simply looking at what's going on in the street. But the court in that case also said that if you tip the scale and if there becomes too much military involvement in domestic life, in our First Amendment activities, in our protest activities and anti-war organizations and all of these kinds of things. If the military becomes too involved, it tips the scale and it violates the basic constitutional principle of military involvement in domestic internal affairs within the United States. And it is the basis for, again, a legal challenge, I suppose, but also for impeachment.
And one last depressing note, and then maybe we should get on to questions about solutions. This isn't the only... these aren't the only programs. I mean, Alberto Gonzalez refused to answer questions about whether the government's opening mail. And indeed, a Republican congressman from Michigan was very, very, very angry at the president recently because he's supposed to be informed on the spy programs. He supported the NSA program, and yet there are new ones that he doesn't even know about.
That would be Mr. Hoekstra.
Hoekstra, yes. So there are questions about solutions, including a question for me, which is very exciting. And that question is, what is the difference between a city council resolution and a ballot initiative, especially in Berkeley? Because Berkeley actually passed a city council resolution on, I believe, April 25th, which we were there for, and we worked with the city of Berkeley on, especially introduced by Councilmember Chris Whittington. What's the difference? The difference is this. When I last counted, I think it's actually a little higher, 74,836 registered voters in Berkeley who actually get to voice an opinion on articles of impeachment based on the Center for Constitutional Rights argument, which, in my opinion, is extremely sound. And so that's the point. You have Berkeley doing it, you have Santa Cruz doing it.
I'm going to have to be a little coy. You might have other cities doing it as well. So point being, it actually gives a voice to the people. And as the movie said, you know, petition is better than no petition. In this case, we're having to act very quickly because we're running up against ballot deadlines. But the Berkeley impeachment initiative sparked a huge amount of media interest. Time, The Economist, Fox News, MSNBC, I mean, all of these things. So hopefully we can actually get people talking about the crimes. Sure, we do have a question on Rule 603 that I'd like to get to, because it could mean that, you know, if we can reconcile this, we can push toward California sending articles of impeachment to the House. Does it force the House to take up the articles of impeachment if they go through Rule 603, which again says that the state legislature, if you put pressure on them, actually will send articles of impeachment, and these are pending in California state legislature now. Is it only one that can do it? And one, or does it have to be two-thirds? And that's mainly it. Is the House required? How does this thing relate to the Constitution? Is there any precedent for it?
Well, I think that you're off there in an area where there are no rules and where there's basically no decision maker, because the courts, are very unlikely to step into this dispute. So, in the end, I think that, in my judgment, the way the rules around this form of, or this format for impeachment are going to be determined, will be by the House of Representatives itself. So it'll be a political process. It'll be a part of a political dialogue and discourse. And if the House turns it down, that will be, you know, that will roll into more politics, more back and forth, more dialectics. But I think it would be a very positive and healthy thing for a state legislature, especially the California legislature, to do. So I support it. I want to say one thing about cities and villages and communities and resolutions and ballot initiatives and all the rest of it. When I've spoken all over on this issue, and on television and right-wing commentators and others as well, glaze over when people talk about California. You know, they talk about Santa Cruz and San Francisco and now Berkeley, of course. And this is California, this is liberal. But it's not only happening in liberal communities. That's the point to understand. It's important that it's happening in communities that are designated as liberal communities. I was in Plattsburgh, New York, which is a community that is dominated by the industrial prison complex, you know what I mean, right? Where the president of the city council is a correctional officer who pushed this resolution through the Plattsburgh City Council, lost the first time, did it again, because he was so outraged primarily about the war in Iraq. But all of these things, once they got going on the war in Iraq, they started to look at where it's happening. They started to look at domestic surveillance by the military, all of the kinds of things we've been talking about tonight, and it has moved mainstream, conservative, and very Republican voters in a place like Plattsburgh, New York. And that's happening throughout the United States, too. So take heart.
Indeed. One more very important question that I have here, and reminding folks that we, Constitution Summer, are very much a nonpartisan group. In fact, we have a multipartisan board. We have a very conservative Republican on our board of directors who is doing fantastic work. He's very active, and we're very good friends. We just don't talk about all issues. But we agree on this one. And the question is, doesn't impeachment detract from the Democrats winning in November? Is this not a huge distraction that's going to screw things up?
Well, you know, I addressed this in the film. I didn't know what they were going to play, but they did play what I did say about it. I don't think so. I think that stuff is whistling in the graveyard. Republicans are frightened of it. I don't think it's an issue. I don't think they want to talk about it to their voters, because their voters might start saying, yeah, maybe impeachment is a good idea. Even people in the so-called base might start saying that. And I'm one of those people, and I think that it's sound in this instance, who is not frightened by the possibility of when you bring a case, making bad law, or the possibility when you raise a political issue, cutting off or mobilizing the base, or frightening off people who otherwise would support you. But that's just my own take on it.
Certainly, you hear that argument a lot, that we have to win 15 seats in the House, and that that will be prejudiced if, and that Roe wants us to raise the, or wants them to raise in Congress the impeachment issue strongly, so that they can say to their base voters in those 15 states, you see, our president, your beloved president, whatever mistakes he's made, is in danger of these crazy Democrats if you let them get in and so forth, would want to impeach him, and that that will bring their base to the polls who otherwise are disgusted with what the administration has been doing in Katrina and other cases, and their failures in Iraq. They might not vote otherwise, but they will vote if we talk impeachment. Now, if there was strong, convincing evidence for that, I would say that was a serious consideration. We cannot afford to pass up a real chance to get an opposition party. Unfortunately, we don't have an opposition party, but the Democrats are all we have. And unless we can get the Democrats into office, then the Republicans, who are aware of how dangerous an unconstitutional this is, and there are many of those, they are screwed too, because they're, like the rest of us, will be stuck with this administration and no investigations, no impeachment. I'm not aware of what this strong evidence is. And I'd like to see the focus groups and the data and the polling, and let's hear some evidence on that. I've asked some political people who know more about it. It's hard to say what the effect would be. In that case, I would want to look, take consideration of the dangers that I do see, the serious dangers of a refusal to talk about impeachment and to identify clearly what is happening as impeachable, as high crimes and misdemeanors. If we don't say that, whether it's in liberal or radical or anywhere else, if we don't say that, we are being complicit in this civilian coup that's taking place. As I said in front of I had 90 seconds or something to talk in front of the city council, and you might find, some people find it hard to believe that I would be able to do that, but I had a clock on me. And my main point there was, yes, I know that you're worried about saying, there goes Berkeley again, you know, crazy Berkeley, of course Berkeley, and so forth. And they really didn't like to raise that. And I said, but you know, this is the town that just proclaimed Cindy Sheehan Day on that very day the council had just honored her. I said, if not here, where? And I would say, if not Oakland, if not San Francisco, where? This has to be done. You know, when Cheney, take off on one more point you were saying, though, when Cheney talks about restoring the powers of the presidency, which he realized when he was a congressman, I guess, in Watergate, were being, in Watergate now, that was 1973, 74, were being contracted, which means I presume that he meant that the president should have resisted the Supreme Court order to turn over those tapes. That's what he must mean. And that they should not have, you know, addressed the issues and so forth. Does that really mean I want to go back to JFK's presidency or to Lyndon Johnson? That would be ominous enough, frankly. But actually, the examples he gives, I put it to you, are very interesting. I think your center ought to focus on this a little bit. The examples that Cheney gives and others give on this is, after all, FDR put 120,000 Japanese in detention camps without habeas corpus. After all, Abraham Lincoln suspended habeas corpus. He's talking about going back to those actions. Now, 2 points in there. First, we already have. Guantanamo is a concentration camp, just like the Japanese. And I think with the next 9/11, there will be hundreds of thousands of Middle Easterners and their, quote, sympathizers, dissenters from the president's current policies in the Middle East, who will be in detention camps in this country. It won't be in Guantanamo. That's what I think lies in our future if we don't act right now to avoid that kind of thing. Second, and they did pick up people without habeas corpus and detain them for long periods. The torture is going on and so forth. But it's very interesting. Here were two cases, one during a civil war in this country, Not that it made it right. What Lincoln did was not right. It's generally agreed was not necessary or right, even though there were extenuating circumstances for him to do it. FDR, in the course of World War II, again, widely recognized as the worst opinion of the Supreme Court ever to uphold those cases. And that's what he wants to go back to. And that's what we've got to prepare.
Have you guys, yes or no, have you taken a good look at the evidence that proves that the Bush administration planned and perpetrated the events of 9/11?
Yes!
Why hasn't that been mentioned? Of all the things you could impeach them for God's sake, that is a pretty big crime. Do you not believe?
Well, I'm going to say this. The answer is no, I haven't looked at it.
I
neither. And the reason I have not looked at it is because I don't want to, I mean, with all due respect, I think that either you look crazy or you lose credibility to look at that stuff. That's what I say.
In other words, you don't believe it's true.
Even if it is true, it's a matter of getting people in Kansas to go along.
That's the discussion.
Let me take that on though. I have looked at it, a lot of it, not as much as some. And I would say there is strong circumstantial evidence that demands investigation, that is sufficient for investigation. For what they would say is an Article 32 proceeding or something like a grand jury proceeding, which has not occurred, of course. What has occurred is very inadequate investigation, non-use of subpoena powers, the admission of cover-ups, the admission of many omissions are there. I have looked at a lot of evidence, some of which I think is strong, and some of which it seems to be very weak, as a matter of fact. So in my own opinion, I know there are people in this audience, many people who I'm aligned with in many respects, or probably every other respect, who are convinced from what they've seen that there is proof. I have not been convinced that you can say there is proof. I haven't been convinced, and I have looked at it. We could go into that. What is there reason to think that it's possible that that happened? Yes, I worked for a president who deliberately sent American men on destroyers in the Tonkin Gulf in harm's way to be shot at to get a war started. That was Lyndon Johnson. He definitely took a risk of a destroyer going down with the loss of many lives. So could that happen? Yes, it did happen. Could it happen again? Might have happened now. Is it proven that it happened? I have to say that I think people who believe that on the basis of stuff that is worth reading, David Ray Griffin's book is very much worth reading, Michael Rubert's stuff is very much worth looking at, seeing the other things and so forth. To say, however, in the face of other items and so forth, that it is proven, in my opinion, goes much further than can be said. It's not enough, I think, to impeach or to convict somebody in a court beyond reasonable doubt. Should we seek such evidence and pursue it? Yes. Will we get that under Republican Congress? Not a chance. Will we get it under Democrats? Not likely, but if we press them, that's the kind of thing we can investigate, and that's why they are determined not to let Democrats get into a majority.
And the point of this evening, and I think the CCR book, is essentially to make an opening argument, as if in the court where you may have evidence of all sorts of things. For example, Katrina was mentioned several times, the non-response to Hurricane Katrina. But the point is that in making the argument, you take what you can absolutely prove, and what is the strongest for you to be able to prove. And this panel, Constitution Summer, the Center for Constitutional Rights, is focusing on illegal domestic spying in violation of the Fourth Amendment and the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act of 1978, which does make it a felony, and he has admitted to it. The President has admitted to all these things. The Iraq War is an illegal aggressive war and a fraud, a criminal fraud. A torture, extraordinary rendition, the illegal detention not only of non-citizens, but also U.S. citizens, Jose Padilla and Yasser Hamdi, which that still hasn't really been settled, at least in the case of Padilla.
Thanks to effective cover-up and refusal to investigate and obfuscation by the Republicans with the cooperation of a lot of Democrats in Congress, including Democrats on the 9/11 Commission, by the way, like Bob Kerry, in my opinion. As a result, we do not have the kind of proof of criminal behavior or impeachable behavior that we do have in a number of other cases. If those allegations were proven, and some of them may well be true, there's no question they would be impeachable. Of course, they would be high crimes of the worst sort. Not yet is that proven. That's not the answer.
I want to know the answer to my question. Is it the same? Because I wanted to know if a stolen election is an impeachable offense, since it implies the guy should not have been president. That seems like the number one impeachable offense to me is that he should never even have been president twice.
You
have to show, by the way, that George Bush was in charge of that. I'm not trying to niggle. I'm being niggling here. I'm just saying. By the way, I can well believe, I mean, there's every reason to believe, it's a very strong case there, that, again, not quite proof in the case of 2004. In the case of 2002, it's pretty clear, in Florida. And I do blame the Democrats, including Gore and Kerry, for not pressing that case. I blame them very much for that. It was a kind of cowardice and consideration they should not. Now, in 2004, as Conyers has shown, and as others have shown in the article by who was it just now?
Robert Kennedy.
Yeah, in Rolling Stone. Very impressive case. I'd say, by the way, there was no question that there was a great deal of fraudulent behavior going on, deliberate behavior. Whether it amounted to actually would have changed the results in Ohio, could have. Again, we don't yet have proof. Does that need investigation? Yes. Is it extremely derelict of the Democrats not to have pressed that so far? Yes, absolutely. Well, I wasn't kidding when I said I'm a self-hating Democrat here. I don't understand. They are a minority, but did the Republicans act this way when they were a minority for so many years? That's not my memory. I don't know what's going on with these guys. But would a Barbara Lee or a Kucinich or a Woolsey press these points, you know, if they had subcommittees and chairmanship? Yes, I really have no doubt of that.
Well, I think that there are two different questions. The 2000 election has already, in a sense, been decided by the United States Supreme Court. Now, in my judgment, that case, Bush versus Gore, is a basis for impeaching the justices who voted. The legal proposition, I guess, the president can fall back on that opinion as a basis for saying that he legitimately assumed the presidency, but it was a disgrace for American jurisprudence that the opinion was decided like that. 2004, I think, is a more open question. I was very persuaded by the Kennedy article. Also, I think that could be a basis if someone could work it up. The difference between those cases and also between the allegations that the president and vice president were behind the 9/11 attacks, the difference between those, as Dan said, is that what they have admitted to, we're going to torture people, we're going to arrest people, we're going to hold people indefinitely, we're going to listen in on your telephone conversations. These are things that they proudly say they have done, are doing right now, and will continue to do. These are statements saying, screw you, we are going to violate the Constitution and run this country the way we want. That's the what's really behind this argument for impeachment. The other stuff, you'll have factual arguments about. That's the real difference between the two bodies.
By the way, that's such an important question about the elections.
No, you're... Can I add a quick comment?
Sorry?
I just want to add in a quick comment. The exit pollster himself, Murkowski, in his post-election report, he acknowledges that he changed Kerry's vote in 26 states in order to match the vote machine count.
Who put it now?
Murkowski, pollster.
And so he had to change Kerry's vote numbers because he acknowledges Kerry won on election day. In his voter exit polls, but he had to change the polls to match the vote machine count.
I would like to hear what Dan's response was.
Well, the question you raised about the election couldn't be more important, but here's the immediate thing here, even in the next few months. What is being done by the Democrats and those conscientious Republicans, I have to believe that there are some in there, who are following their orders, but with some reluctance. What are they doing about the next election, about 2006 and about 2008? What is being done to prevent these? We now have the whole list, not the whole list probably, but we have quite a cookbook of how to rig an election from Ohio and Florida and no doubt other states. What is being done point by point to prevent these same manipulations from going on? From knocking off not only the felons, but everybody who has a name like a felon somehow automatically from the list. From deliberately not having enough voting machines, for example, in black areas or poor areas. All these kinds of things go on. So I'm not aware that that much is going on. The Democrats totally failed us to prevent what they saw in 2000 from happening again in Ohio. And they knew Ohio was going to be a battleground state.
I'm a Green Party congressional candidate running on an impeachment, 9/11 Truth, Peace, and Justice platform. I organized the Citizens International Inquiry into 9/11. We have extremely solid evidence that the government has been lying about 9/11, using it to get support for illegal wars and the attack on the Constitution and the Bill of Rights.
Is there a question?
Yeah, well, I bet you we have very solid evidence that they have lied, they have destroyed evidence, and they've been covering up 9/11.
Okay.
We also have very solid evidence that they were complicit in 9/11. Would you be willing to look at it?
Evidence here. We haven't looked at it. So,
okay.
And you can say that you have evidence.
And we also, the Green Party, which you have ignored in this whole conversation, it's like we don't even exist.
Uh-huh.
The Green Party is the only party that's standing up for 9/11 truth, for a genuine investigation, and also calling for impeachment. I think it's really unfortunate that you pretend that there isn't a Green Party and only talk about Democrats and Republicans. That if we could get out all the incumbents who have supported a criminal regime, we could replace them with Greens and independents.
Folks, if you could keep them to questions, especially ones that we can answer, this is based on four crimes that have been researched. They have been researched by us. I mean, you folks may have researched these other issues, but we can't really speak to them. We've
She asked you if you'd look at it. The correct answer is yes.
Yeah. Right on.
Next question, please.
Okay. Well, I got out of the Republican Party, and I'm going into the Independent Party because of the Constitution. And this is a Republican, not a democracy. That's mob rule, and everybody's always saying we have to stand up for democracy when this nation is a republic. Another statement I put on one of your cards. I put on one of your cards, one of the cards to you, was that why don't we just get out of the United Nations and kick the United Nations out of the United States, and then we don't end up going to these wars because of some kind of a statement, you know, by the president being able to do it without the Constitution and without the Congress's permission.
Okay. Is there a question?
That's all.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
That's it, folks. Well, you've already had several comments. So
yeah,
thank you
question.
For coming out.
I want to thank all of you for being here.
Really
appreciate it.
Thank you all for coming out.
But I just have one question. We have the international election monitors that monitor democracies worldwide. They came to the United States in 2004, and they have a massive document that talks about our broken election system, electoral system, and within that they include the vote machines. Now, what I'm wondering is, can a group like yours go through that document and hold the United States responsible to international standards for our electoral system and help be the, you know, the focal point like you are now for this to push our electoral system forward and make it adhere to what international standards are? It would certainly really, really help us. And there's been many, you know, reports that you guys do your homework on too.
The question is, should the
can you guys spearhead this for us?
Will the Council of Constitutional Rights review the election monitoring data and take a position?
Yeah. Is that it, fairelection.us, the report?
If Mr. Goodman could answer, he's the legal person. Is that okay? Sorry.
There's a website. What is it again?
Fairelection.us. The report, a pre and post report by the International Election Monitors is there.
I just want to say, you're talking about a lawsuit and stuff. What we do at the Center for Constitutional Rights, primarily, other than, you know, occasional books like this, is we do lawsuits. We've got 9 or 10 lawyers. We're pretty swamped. We've got, you know, the whole, we do a lot of work around Guantanamo, around other post-9/11 stuff, and a number of other issues, prison issues, and so on. And we're pretty swamped, but the issue that you're talking about, some kind of litigation around the elections, is a possibility. Certainly willing to look at it. Fairelection.us, I will look at it, take a look.
Great.
If there's a basis for a case, we'd be interested.
Just on the vote machines alone, forget the election. Let's just get... outlaw these vote machines, which the International Election Monitor is telling us to do. Thank you very, very, very much.
Thank you very much.
I want to comment one thing. A lot of the questions here, I think, reflect something which certainly I'm sure we all share, and that is impeachment is not the impeachment campaign, which I say is essential and important, is not the only campaign that is essential and urgent and important right now. It will not do the job that we need, which is vast and complex by itself at most. Are there many other issues that can be raised? Are the lies that we're talking about here the only lies of the administration? No, no, no. Every time they open their mouths, they lie. Some they can't. But sure, there are others. Are there other things? The election issue is of extreme importance. Nothing is more individually more important than that, actually. The voting machines. Voting machines without a paper trail to allow those is like just writing off democracy, essentially. It's absurd. And there are many issues like that are very important. So we're just talking here on this issue. By the way, I really want to compliment your center. It's always, over and over again, in the forefront of what needs to be done. Terrific work. I didn't mean to suggest, by the way, I thought the movie was very good, and I do think Michael Ratner, who's a terrific guy from all, I don't know him personally, but what I read is terrific. He misspoke on some things there. I think that has to be corrected. Those mistakes are not in this book. The book is very solid. That's what I was checking here earlier. So this is one of the things. We have an awful lot of work ahead of us. We're in a terrible crisis, and this is one of the things we cannot neglect. Impeachment is one of the issues that we can't be silent about. That's all.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you for coming out. I was asked to pick up a literature on your way out. We are all young people who are Constitution Summers. We have young people who put themselves on the line, both financially and in other ways. If you could possibly help out, we appreciate the donations tonight, the ones you've already given, and if anybody's in a position to...
I want to congratulate this initiative. There's just a few young men here and women working. Like the people under General Washington in Valley Forge, and they did win, actually. They got us who we are.
Thank you, Dr. Ellsworth. It's really an honor. It's been an honor. Thank you.